Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rink, Jack Spencer, and our special guest this week here at MERS World Headquarters, State Senator Tom Barrett. Thanks for coming over here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Guys, there's a lot to talk about from the Mackinac Conference, and we're going to get to it here in just a second. But first, I happen to see Alyssa Slotkin at the Grand River Assembly Plant down here in Lansing. She was talking with General Motors UAW strikers, and we talked to her, and the reporting corps was able to talk to her about her thoughts on this Ukrainian development and Donald Trump. And I wanted to get that audio in first before we talk about the island.
Have you ever found this Ukrainian stuff?
Yes.
Yeah. Can you give me your thoughts on this?
I mean, for me, I'm still trying to understand exactly what happened. We obviously don't have the whistleblower report. But if these allegations are true, I think we're in a different era. And I really do. I as a national security professional, if these allegations are correct, that the president basically bribed a foreign country in order to get dirt on one of his opponents, I mean, that's a serious problem. And so a bunch of us have been talking all weekend, a bunch of my national security peers who are also members of Congress. And for me, this just feels and smells differently. And so, you know, I know we have the Director of National Intelligence coming up on Thursday to the Hill. That for me is a very important moment. And if he does not provide information on this whistleblower case as he is required to by law, I think that we're in a new moment where the Congress should exercise its full authority on those issues.
So okay. Why is this so concerning?
So, you know, again, we need to understand the true details behind the allegations. But right now, the allegation is that the President of the United States stopped a shipment of defense articles, of military equipment, to a partner nation until and unless they provided dirt on a political opponent. That is a really striking allegation. And if that's true, I think we're in a different moment. I mean, as a national security professional, as a CIA officer, that kind of thing goes so beyond the pale of what is acceptable for our own national security, right? That military equipment was there to defend against the Russians in Ukraine. But then also asking a foreign government to provide dirt on your political opponent should not be an acceptable thing, especially after what we went through in 2016, right? It's one thing for candidate Trump to do it. It's another thing for President Trump to do it.
Would you support impeachment proceedings?
I need to understand what exactly this whistleblower case says, but if the allegations are true, I think we're in a new era, and I would certainly consider a whole range of options.
Kind of a different tone here from Alyssa Slotkin. She has been very hesitant to approach the impeachment subject before. This is certainly a new development and something we could see from other Democratic members from Congress who represent politically competitive districts where impeachment up until now has not really been a subject they've wanted to touch. They have not wanted to touch on. So a pretty significant development, guys, and we'll see how this plays out. So, John, I bought 3 bricks of fudge from the island, and I saw you got some treats that you brought into the office. That was very nice of you.
It was very nice of me, but I can't take full credit for it because we were walking by Representative Matt Maddox's popcorn party, and one of his staffers just kind of gave us 3 bags, and I said, that's great. We'll bring them back to the office and put them out there. So thanks, Representative Maddox.
Greg McNeely and John Selleck will be joining us a little later. We had a little segment with them out on the front porch, so we'll get to that here in a minute. But a few things that we wanted to go over, and the big hubbub last night as I was looking at my Twitter feed was a national story on how history has been shattered at Mackinac Island because Mike Pence brought his 8-car motorcade through the island. And John, I gotta say, I was out at the airport to watch this happen because I just wanted to see history be made, because it was really pretty exciting to watch these enormous helicopters, and the senator can talk a lot about these because I think he's flown one or two before, land at the airport and then watch the motorcade slowly wind through with a Michigan State Police bicycle escort right up to the Grand Hotel. I put that Twitter feed out there, and we've gotten 22,000 views, and I thought, wow, this is great. till I saw Paul Egan had one for the Detroit Free Press that has received 5 million views. The comments have just been out of this world. People are going berserk on social media about this event.
Well, and it's so funny, though. I think this is my 22nd trip up to MacCon. If you spend any time there, you're going to realize on the west side of the island there's a dock, and they literally bring in heavy equipment all the time. Saturday night, we were out for dinner with my wife, and there was an ambulance that pulled right down Main Street. There's gasoline-powered motor vehicles there all the time, every day of the week, every day of the year. And it's like that we kind of somehow shattered this thing that was, you know, so pure and so, you know, pristine that it's just not reality.
I think on Sunday when we were having breakfast, there was an ambulance down the street, Francis and Finn flagged
me. The guy that was serving us our spaghetti dinner at the hotel, we asked him, and he says, oh, yeah, we see an ambulance down that street every day, at least one a day during the busy season.
Well, let's go to our porter here, former porter Jack Spencer.
Former dock porter and worked on the golf course on Mackinac Island. I was there 2.5 years. I didn't get up there until the week after President Ford got there, and I do not remember whether he flew in or exactly what happened. I also know Truman was on the island. I think he stayed 2 or 3 days. I think there are actually photos in the hotel, and he actually took a morning constitutional walk with a bunch of reporters following him around.
Now, that would have been sweet.
But I do not know the conveyance for getting him over at the time, and of course, these were different times. But to me, your point is well taken. As somebody who's worked on the island before, the world's divided between people who sort of know what's really going on and the rest of the world are fudgies. And this is a good story for the rest of the world, which are fudgies.
All right. So, Senator Barrett, I wanted to talk to you about just kind of the security. I mean, did we really need 8 cars in a motorcade? I mean, couldn't we got them on a little horse and carriage and just kind of wheeled them up to the front porch? I mean, that would have just been really picturesque and fun. How come we can't do that?
Well, I think, you know, times have changed and the world's a different place than it was even from when President Ford came up to the island. You know, he had an assassination attempt against him later in his term after he came to Mackinac Island. Of course, since then, Ronald Reagan had an assassination attempt that was nearly successful against him. We had 9/11 happen and, you know, countless other security threats. So I don't think we can just take things for granted and say, oh, you know, throw security away and we're going to do this for the photos and everything else. You know, the world is a different place than it was, to your point. Things are different today than they've ever been, and we're at a precarious point in the world, just geopolitically and national security and everything else. So if the Secret Service said, hey, this is how we're going to do it, I don't think it's, you know, really for any of us to say, oh, they shouldn't have done that for optics reasons or anything else. I mean, at the end of the day, we got to be serious about how we treat these things.
8 cars, though. It seems like a lot.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I'm not a security expert as it relates to the Secret Service and how they do things. Certainly they want, you know, some type of standby vehicle just in case something of a disaster does happen. So I don't know what their minimum security profile looks like. I'm sure they didn't, you know, spice it up in any way just because they're coming to Mackinac Island. It's not like they wanted to put on a grand motorcade or anything like that.
They also do decoys. They had two helicopters that went in separate directions when they left.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. So they do have those, you know, security parameters in place. And if you think about it, you're on an island, so your avenues of approach and departure are pretty limited. So if you are somebody intent on causing harm to someone else, you can anticipate the route they're going to take, what they're going to do, where they're going to turn, what those, you know, choke points are going to be and everything else. You know, again, I'm not an expert on these things, but when you set up and you anticipate, you know, in a combat situation, I did convoy security in Iraq for a year, and you look at, okay, where are our choke points, where are our slowdown points where we have to be vulnerable, and what are we going to do to mitigate those risks and things like that. So the Secret Service, they plan for this stuff day in and day out, every single day of the year. They're moving dignitaries around, and they have to be careful about how they do that.
The other thing is none of us have read the threat assessment book either.
Right, right, exactly. And there are threats every single day against our country that we don't know about, and we blissfully go along ignorant of that as fudgies, as you would say. You know, and the world is made up of fudgies. So, yes. You know.
So we have these grand visions in the media because we weren't given a heads up about how the vice president was going to come to the island. We were told that they had alternatives if the haze was too bad and it was going to be too tough for the copters.
But remember, though, they published the route of John Kennedy in the newspaper when he was shot in Dallas. Right.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that's it.
There was a map in the newspaper, if I remember right.
thanks, media.
I mean, why wouldn't you tell the media? Oh, he's coming in the helicopter. About 11:50, so we turn that corner up there.
Yeah, but, yeah. And then Ted Cruz's dad got involved, and you know the rest is history, right? So, yeah.
So what happened though is that the vice president had to fly in Air Force Two to Pelston because the airport at Mackinac Island wasn't long enough to accommodate.
Yeah, the runway isn't long enough for Air Force Two.
So they had to copter him in, and tell our listeners about these copters because you have some experience with them.
Well, these are some friends of mine in my National Guardian are a companion company based out of Selfridge. They've got these giant Chinook helicopters that have a tremendous lift ability. I think they actually put the Secret Service vehicles onto the Chinooks as well and got some of them over that way, which is pretty incredible. I mean, some of these guys have got, you know, countless flight hours in Iraq and Afghanistan and some of the harshest conditions, and for them to be able to fly the vice president was, you know, one of the high points of their military career, I know.
How come they can't land these things on the front lawn of the Grand Hotel? Because we were wondering, as media, wonder if they're going to try and do something like that. That would have been kind of a neat spectacle to see.
Yeah, I think you could land it on the front lawn of the Grand Hotel as long as you weren't delivering a football in the process of doing that. So, but no, you know, the front porch and you know, kind of front lawn of the Grand Hotel is pretty sloped down, and that flat spot, I mean, I don't have this, you know, by heart or anything, but that the kind of area that it leads to flat ground is smaller. I mean, and these are big helicopters. There's a lot of trees around, and as you have a smaller footprint in which you have to land, your approach is forced to become more vertical, which doesn't give you the same margin for, you know, an escape route or area to fly away. If you lose an engine, for example, or some other mechanical ability of the aircraft, the more vertical you are, the more dangerous you are, and therefore you want to give yourself room to escape in a situation like that, unless it's absolutely necessary. You know, if you're coming into a confined landing area because you have no other option, then obviously you do what you have to do. But if you have alternative means, you want to do the safest thing you can.
Hmm. Okay, that's interesting.
It just makes me wonder, because I had never thought of it before, but it's a little surprising that there isn't a helicopter landing area on there, because I'm talking about just the medical situation, mm-hmm. with people wanting to be evacuated from the island in the case of an emergency or mm-hmm. an accident or something.
They probably use the airport on the island and then use the emergency vehicles. You know, if they have to quickly, you know, take someone out, they could have a helicopter come to the airport on the island, I would assume. And there may be other areas, you know, kind of behind the scenes that are able to have a helicopter land that aren't really visible from Main Street or the route up to the Grand or whatever, that may be, you know, a few blocks back.
Well, you can land on the golf course maybe, but of course, yeah. If you brought in President Trump, you wouldn't ever get him off the golf course once he was on. So,
now, at the Mackinac Leadership Conference, one of the panels that you were on, and you were actually the MC of, had to do with service, and one of the folks on that panel was John James. Would it be fair to say that outside of the vice president coming here, that John James had the biggest reception of everyone at this conference?
Absolutely. You know, John James is a rock star in the party right now and just doing a great job. I mean, he's somebody who really, really galvanized the base of the party last year in his race for the U.S. Senate. And, you know, he's going for another round of that. And I give him a lot of credit because it's a tough thing to do. I mean, this is a big state when you go out and try and win votes and everything else. And Michigan's an unpredictable political climate right now. And he's doing this because he thinks it's the right thing to do. And he thinks the future of the country depends on it. And I give him all the credit for it. And the base is behind him 110%.
Yeah, it seemed like it. This was a different leadership conference, John, because and we're going to talk a lot about this with Greg McNeely and John Selleck, but a couple things I wanted to mention is that the party didn't have control of the whole hotel this year like they have in years past. There were certain rooms that weren't available. For the first time, we had a metal detector since we had Pence coming in. We had the long lines were not to go to the dining room to listen to people speak. It was to try and get through this metal detector. Those were kind of some of the things that really stood out to me.
Yeah, and it was interesting too. There just had a different feel. The last two of these, we've actually conducted a straw poll. There really wasn't any issues to straw poll on, so we didn't this year.
You didn't want to do John James versus Bob Carr and do like 99-1?
Right.
Same thing with, you know, who's challenging Trump? I can't remember his name, so there you go. We didn't want to poll on that either. But it did have a different feel. And the other thing is that I kind of walked away from this wondering about the future of this party. Look, Brian Zara mentioned it Saturday night. They've kind of lost control of a court. They had confirmed control of the Supreme Court for a long time. There's a lot of speculation about whether or not the Republicans will be able to hold the House, depending on what happens with the presidential election next year. There's those questions that come about through the redistricting commission. If that goes forward, the Republicans kind of lose control of the pen for the Senate seats. There's a lot of questions up in the air right now, I think, for this party, and that's kind of what I walked away thinking about.
Well, let's take a look at the races that usually embody these conventions, that the primaries that get people excited. We didn't really have but one competitive congressional primary, and that's the 3rd Congressional District. And the candidates who were there, and 4 of the 5 candidates were there, but they were walking around with name tags and saying hi, but it wasn't like this huge blast of volunteers going around. I was talking to someone on the island who said, you know what, there wasn't that many people from my district here to convince. I mean, yeah, I could have spent a lot of money and had a big show, but for what? I mean, how many people am I really going to impact? And so when you have something, you know, a smaller race like that, and a congressional race is big, but when you only have, you know, a few people there to convince, what are you going to do? Same thing with Oakland County Exec. I was expecting to see maybe more people, like, being interested or talked about. The only person I heard about at the island was Ruth Johnson, and when I talked to her about it, she said, yeah, people are asking me about it, but she didn't really seem like...
Excited?
No. She didn't really seem like, oh, yeah, we're going to freaking go at it.
Oakland County's getting to be a tough battleground. I mean, it's pretty tight. It's pretty tight. And it's not a shoo-in like it used to be. I mean, when Brooks Patterson first won that seat, that was a whole different situation.
So what was your takeaway? I mean, we felt like it was different. Did you feel like it was different?
It was different. I've been going to this conference most time. You know, I haven't made it every single time, but for probably the last 10, 12 years or so. And we always enjoy it, and this time was no different in that aspect, that we got friends that we don't always see, you know, and get to catch up with and everything, and that was fun. But to your point, there wasn't any competitive, you know, I guess friction there to drive out different dynamics and everything. We also don't have any statewide elected officials in the Republican Party in Michigan for the first time in as long as I can remember. So that, I think, changed the dynamics a bit as well. There were some differences, but overall, you know, the party is unified, which is a good thing. And that unity sometimes changes the dynamics that go on at some of these events as well.
I think the biggest dynamic that's changed has been a complete reshuffling and realignment of the two parties. And I don't know whether either party has completely adjusted to that yet. Trump has, you know, with everybody making fun of him and he's this terrible person and whatever it is you play, people have missed the underlying change that came. And arguably that was laying there waiting to happen. And I think that's going to be a key next year, is what happens with both parties and how well they adjust to that. I have not seen an awful lot of movement in the structure of either party in the direction of, hey, we've got a whole bunch of different people interested in us now, and a whole bunch of the old folks don't like us as much.
Now, we also had a couple ballot proposals that are being out in circulation right now that the Republicans or folks who align with the Republican Party would seem to like. One of them was the heartbeat bill, that once you are able to detect a heartbeat, then you can no longer perform an abortion. I did see that those folks, those volunteers out, but it was by St. Anne's Church on Sunday. Did you see any, John?
I saw Right to Life was out by the gatehouse on Saturday afternoon.
Okay. Did you see any, Senator?
Yeah, I saw Right to Life was out somewhere right on that curve as you start to go up to the Grand Hotel from that, was it Market Street? Or I can't remember which.
Oh,
but anyway,
yeah,
on
right.
The walkway right up to the Grand that everybody takes. They were standing out there and collecting signatures as well. So I did see them. Of course, I sponsored the bill in the Senate and have signed the petition already, so I let them know that I'd already signed it so that I wouldn't duplicate my signature. But they were out there collecting signatures from other people on the island.
We did have a visit from a U.S. Senate candidate, though, in media room land.
Bob Carr.
Bob Carr came and talked to us. He'd probably still be talking to us
at
now.
At the most inopportune time, Saturday, as we're trying to finish our stories, he comes in and he sits down for about an hour and a half. And it's just sort of like, we haven't eaten all day, and you know, we want to be nice. And he's a very nice man.
He is very nice.
Very nice man. He's got some great stories.
He's got some great stories.
And if you don't believe him, ask him. But let me tell you, though, he said that he had one sign on the island, and the John James people
took it down,
took that sign and rolled it up and just put it off to the side. And he had a carriage driver tell him that he saw it, and so he went and he just unfurled a sign. He put it somewhere else. So the John James sign.
I'm sure he's not the first candidate to ever have a sign taken down.
I saw there was a yard that had several John James signs in them, and adjacent to that there was a Bob Carson that had moved over, and then there was on the little, like, I guess fence or little rock wall that was there, there was a placard that said, "I have permission, Bob Carr." So nobody touched it after that, but it was originally, there was a bunch of John James stuff, so I think there may have been some confusion as to who had permission to be there or not.
Oh, yeah.
Well, so you don't get the excuse that that sign bothered the horses?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
I saw a Livonia City Council sign on the island.
Did
so
you really?
I did.
Didn't see that
yeah.
one.
Really?
Yeah.
Boy, I bet you that influenced a few people.
Yeah.
Three or four, maybe?
Right. Exactly.
But we talked to Bob Carr, and I told him as soon as he gets his petition signatures, we'll have him right on this podcast.
There were many signs, though. I mean, I saw Huizenga on the Scheffler's Ferry dock.
And again, you don't have a lot of divided primaries going on right now where there's that happening, and we're not yet at that point where we have statewide elected offices coming up immediately. There's no presidential, you know, primary that's contested right now. I mean, that stuff hasn't happened in quite a long time.
We're going to let you go here in a second, but we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the budget and transportation while you're in here. Now, you've been kind of the point person on the Senate side dealing with transportation. As far as additional funding, under what circumstances would you vote for additional funding for the roads?
You know, I'd be interested in, if you're talking about any additional funding, we can certainly redirect money out of the current budget. We can, I'm, you know, very interested in this refinancing option that we're looking at to, you know, extend the timeline under which we pay back some of our debt obligations, things that don't increase the tax burden on you know, the taxpayers of the state. That's something that I'm very protective of and looking for different ways in which we can, you know, fund our obligations without putting the burden onto taxpayers that have already picked up the tab consistently and consistently and consistently again and again and again.
So as far as a gas tax increase, are you a hell no on a gas tax increase?
I've given my concerns to the leader. So, know, the Senate Majority Leader knows where I'm at, but I don't want to get too far out ahead of my caucus and what they may be looking at. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think we got to look at alternative ways in which we deal with transportation. You know, we've put hundreds of millions of dollars more in this budget into transportation, and we're starting to get to the point where, you know, the sponge is getting saturated and you can't always put more in because we have a limited timeline in which we have to pave roads in our state. We have a workforce constraint where we don't have as many people that are, you know, stepping forward to do these jobs. We don't have them. We got a material shortage. We got a cost of materials going up in every single community, it seems like, in our state. And then we have, you know, the machinery to do it, of course, and moving that around that all takes, you know, truck drivers and everything else. So we've got a lot of other dynamics beyond just money. And if we continue to just throw money at the problem without making other, you know, smart strategic decisions, we're just going to have the cost of our infrastructure go up without getting more for what we're paying for.
Do you foresee, as Senate Majority Leader Shirky has said, a real concentration on this issue after the budget is done in terms of, you know, maybe coming up with a solution before the next State of the State address or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is something that we do have an obligation to look at what we're going to do for the long-term infrastructure of our state. You know, I think that state government, we have a few primary responsibilities: education, public safety, and infrastructure. And those are things that are very, very important. And infrastructure right now is obviously not where it needs to be. So we need to do more to address that. Now, we have put, you know, money into this, and this takes effect over time. We're carrying forward some of the 2015 roads plan money, bringing that in a little bit early, those types of things. But it's not like a light switch that goes off and all of a sudden roads are fixed. It takes time to get out of the, you know, trouble that we've been in. So, you know, and I've let my constituents know that. They're like, well, there's still a pothole outside of this street at this point or whatever. And I said, well, you know, it's going to take a while to catch up to some of the decades-long neglect that's been there. We're not going to get out of it in 2 years or 3 years. This is going to be a multi-year, you know, situation. And there will always be potholes. No matter what we do, there will always be potholes in our state. We just have to be realistic about making sure we, keep our roads in the best condition we can for the taxpayers of our state that have paid money to the state to be used appropriately to give them the best quality we can do.
And the last question I wanted to ask you, do you have any aversions to expanding the base of the sales tax to more services?
You know, that's not something that I really support right now. I'd certainly have to learn more about it if there's a trade-off that can be done or something to that effect. But, you know, just a straight-up services tax is not something that I really support.
All right. Tom Barrett, State Senator. Thanks for joining us here on the podcast, and we'll move on to our next segment.
Let's go.
Special guests here at the Grand Hotel front porch, Greg McNeely and John Selleck. Thanks for joining us for the podcast, guys.
Happy to be here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. So what's the headline coming out of here? We're news guys. We like to get the hook and we want to get people's attention grabbed here. Greg, what do you think the headline is here out of the island?
Republicans ready to rumble.
All right, John?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think Laura Cox and her team have done a really great job putting on a flawless conference. And some people said, well, it's kind of sleepy. It seems kind of quiet. But really, that's a victory for them because what it means is we're not at war with ourselves. The party is not infighting and having a lot of primaries. They are focused on the general election. I think that's a common trait that everybody would talk about here.
Does that reduce the amount of interest in the conference, though? Because I'm used to seeing hordes of kids wearing T-shirts, you know, pitching for one candidate or the other candidate, and you're just not seeing it. No straw polls, John? We haven't been able to do a straw poll yet?
I'm very depressed that we don't have a straw poll to do, but what were we going to ask, you know?
It was a bad conference for consultants, a good conference for the party.
And for clickbait, right? So it is of less interest maybe to media and to your readers because, as John notes, John Selleck notes, we're unified on the radical ideas that we oppose. And I think that's where the energy from the Michigan Republican Party is going to come. When we look at that, our opposition, our political opposition, the Democrats are just freaking wacky. I mean, you got Elizabeth Warren, who in 2003 supported vouchers along with Cory Booker, and now, you know, they want to shut down every public charter school, and you have Medicaid for all, socialism for all, the free college $1 trillion giveaway. I mean, just these crazy ideas, not to mention reparations, which is not going to sell in Michigan, but that's what the Democrat Party stands for.
One thing that I've kind of picked up this particular conference, and it has been a little different in this regard, but there's been this treatment of John James like he's the rock star. Like, I can't get in with 3 feet of this guy. He's always got a halo of folks who want to shake his hand, just get some FaceTime with him. John, explain this phenomenon of John James. Why do people love him?
Well, he's lovable, first of all. That's not always a quantifiable thing to measure. But he's still a fresh face in the party. He excited the party on his run last year, and he's starting to do it again. He's got a resume that fits our times right now. He's actually gone out and accomplished things both for our country and the military, and as a private businessman and be able to create jobs and know what's going on out there. He's just not another politician. And our party likes that. And I think that's why you're seeing the excitement for him.
I would add to that. I think there's a dimension that John James connects with the psyche of Republican voters in that we first met him basically through the visuals of him sending a missile right at terrorists. That strikes resonance with Republicans because we want to stand strong to protect this country, and that it just connects in a way. So we look at him as a terrorist slayer, and that makes everybody happy.
One of the questions I want to get both your reactions to is obviously the vice president was up here, laid out the argument for another 4 years from his perspective. I always go back to the numbers, 10,704 votes separated Donald Trump in Michigan from Hillary Clinton. How hard or how difficult is it going to be to sort of repeat that in the state? I think the last time was George Bush Sr. that we went Republican in a presidential election. So give me your read on what they have to do, what the likelihood is of repeating that is next year.
Yeah, and when he won, Bush 41 won Michigan back in 88, he came to this conference. He was in the dining room behind us. That was 16 Mackinac ago in my first Mackinac conference. I wasn't able to legally drink, so it was, wasn't as exciting as some of the others.
You didn't say you didn't drink, though.
Correct. Michigan's going to be tough. Look, there's two schools of thought. Did Trump win Michigan or did Hillary lose it? I personally am from the perspective that Hillary lost Michigan. Not only was the vote margin essentially the undervote out of the city of Flint alone, but when you look at the 75,000 people who voted in the election but did not vote for president, those votes are largely split between two areas, Detroit and West Michigan. And in West Michigan, those were Republicans who weren't ready to support him. He got fewer Republican votes in winning Michigan than George W. Bush did in 2004.
In losing Michigan.
I think it's arguable that Hillary Clinton lost Michigan. So will they lose it again? I think it goes to who they nominate. I think Elizabeth Warren makes Michigan very competitive. And so, you know, I think is whoever the wackiest person they have is the best candidate they should nominate.
Is that why you've been going on to Marianne Williamson's site and encouraging people to contribute $5 to keep her on the debate stage?
Absolutely. Get your crystals out and, you know, vote for Marianne.
So does this mean you guys are concerned about what happens if Joe Biden then is the presidential nominee?
Well, it's obvious, I think, going back to how do we win Michigan? Michigan's always a tough place. That's why we have a good time. That's why we're all still covering this election. After being in politics forever, you guys, it's always a battle. It's always going to be a fight. But like Greg said to start the show, the Democrats are going to do a lot to help Michigan be in play. They're already doing that with some of their more radical and aggressive policies on that front. They're not doing themselves any favor, and even how they handle impeachment proceedings against the president, they just are like the gang that couldn't shoot straight. And it's because there are so many of them that are so ambitious to jump in. When you have the governor of Montana and other places like that, and the mayor of New York, think, God, I might as well get in. I got a shot at this. They're just gumming up the works for themselves. They're tripping over themselves nonstop. I agree with Greg that Hillary Clinton lost Michigan last time. Trump put himself in position to win. His messaging is the right messaging to talk to union voters. He's still trying to talk to those union voters during this GM strike carefully and trying to thread the needle. He's still trying to do it. Bernie Sanders is going to come here on Wednesday and say, hey, auto workers, we should take away your health care, the health care that you fought so hard to get. That's so much better than what Medicaid is or Medicare. So the Democrats are doing the job for the president at this point.
Can you imagine how all these MEA members are going to feel when they realize that their nominee wants to throw them off their health care and put them on Medicaid? Like, I mean, they have the best health care system that money can buy, and they won't have it under a Democrat reign. So it's some interesting choices and different policy questions that Michigan voters will have that I think we saw a realignment 4 years ago. We could have a realignment. Coalitions and identity groups are in play, and these issues are what are pushing and pulling them.
And I'd also say real quick, you said earlier, what's the difference between Biden and everyone else? If you just go on the Real Clear Politics webpage and look at all the polling data, you know, it'll show Biden ahead by a little bit more, based really on name ID and sort of a vague sense of comfort, not on anything other than that. And that every other candidate that's out there for the Democrats is tied or within the margin of error: Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Pete, everyone else. But Joe Biden is a problem for the Democrats, and we don't even have to say it. The Democrats are saying it for us. They're terrified, and he's like one bad day from tanking. The president has shown he can have a bad day, and he restarts the agenda the next day. I don't think Biden has that skill set.
And if it is Biden, you indicated that Elizabeth Warren could make Michigan close. What odds do you give the president of winning Michigan if it's Joe Biden versus Donald Trump in Michigan?
The honest answer would be, I think it's 45-55 in Biden's favor.
And what if Gretchen Whitmer is the running mate? Does the odds...
50-50. I mean...
You think that hurts?
Yeah, 49% gas tax with no experience in her sort of unstable approach to leadership and walking out on negotiations with the budget like infant terrible. I just don't think that will fly.
What do you think, Sal? Do you think that Gretchen Whitmer would be a drag on the ticket in Michigan? That would be almost counterintuitive to why she would be on in the first place.
Look, I was just waiting for the time that we were going to turn the corner and get to state politics so we could tie all these things together. I've been saying all along I thought that Gretchen Whitmer was going to end up being mentioned on these lists for vice president, and why wouldn't she? She's, you know, young age, she's attractive, she's super articulate, she's very aggressive, she's the governor of a very key state that, as you said earlier, John, the president only won by 10,000 votes. She needs to show something, though. And in this first year, it seems like she put everything on the gas tax, almost in a kind of, just tell me what the solution is. I don't want to play around with it. So that's her bravado talking. Yeah, I'll just go out and sell 45 cents. There was no other alternative plan to go on. There was no, like, kind of parallel track of, here are a bunch of other issues I'll build victories on and build relationships with the legislature on as I'm going. And what I kind of remember the other day is the success of the vaping issue that she took on is very different than a typical issue where she'd have to work with the legislature, make her case, and go through it. It reminds me of some of these books that talked about when President Obama got his mojo back after 2012, he just started governing by executive order and taking his own actions. Vaping is an example of that for her, but she needs like six more vaping issues in a row to get herself rolling, and I somehow doubt that she has those in her quiver.
Do you think, Greg, that Mike Shirkey is driving the agenda for the state, or is it Gretchen Whitmer?
I think Senate Majority Leader Shirkey and Speaker Chatfield are driving the agenda. And we hear more about the governor's puppy than about serious solutions.
It is a cute puppy, though.
And everybody loves a puppy, but it's a serious job, and I don't think we've seen a serious governor yet. And so she is giving up a lot of opportunity and squandering. I think the first 200 days of her administration have been completely lost, squandered. Now, the question is this baked into her DNA, or is it an issue of experience? Because she was a backbencher with no experience at actually governing. So now that she'll have a year under her belt, will she be better next year? If her deficit is due to experience, then she'll get better as time goes on. If she's just fundamentally incapable of being a serious leader, well, then the state's going to have a rough 4 years.
I think Greg asks and poses a real question there for her. First of all, everybody talked about she'd be one of the most experienced governors coming in because she had 14 years in the legislature. But I've been in the legislature. You can observe it from the outside. She was not the executive of something. This is a very different job from the legislature. And she was in the minority the whole time. And the minority is not always about strategy. A lot of times it's about tactics. You have to respond. Today, the majority did something. I'm going to respond. The letter saying you're going to go on your getaway to Mackinac Island is an example of that. We're in September, and we're doing tactics. So understanding the difference between strategy and tactics is going to be important. I'd also mention, though, I would not just sit back and think that they've got her won by any means. You remember when she got in the governor's race, it was literally like January 4th, 2017. She was sitting in her kitchen with Skubik and talking about how she was in. And almost from the start, there were little stumbles and complaints and staffing changes. And then the rumors, Mike Duggan, a tactician, not happy with how things are going. And they did everything they could to replace her, but she seemed to learn and adjust like a coach would do at halftime. Mm-hmm. As time went on, she got stronger and stronger. So can she repeat that same thing? Almost anybody that comes into the governor's office is going to have a learning curve. So like Greg said, the question is, can she make those adjustments and move on? Or is it just not to her personality? It was more structured to that minority thing. I would be more cautious and think that if I'm on the Republicans, that she will learn, she will get it better. There were people up here in the bars last night already talking about what staff structure changes should she have or could she have? What changes could she make in response to this? Really, she got outmaneuvered massively by Speaker Chatfield. And I would just say that I think those two as a team, everybody looked at the governor and said, boy, she's like a powerhouse of talent. She's going to come in, blow the world away. Nobody gave any kind of light or time of day to the idea that Shirkey and Chatfield were going to kind of rule the roost, so to speak. They've been a great team, and by a team, they balance each other. Shirky's comfortable being in front of the cameras, kind of being the statesman, and really being the adult that the governor keeps mentioning that she thinks that she is. Chatfield is kind of like 1990s Engler. He's behind the scenes. He's cutting the deals. He said, oh, Christine Gregg, are you feeling lonely? Come on over here. Let's cut a deal. I know the governor's ignoring you and not giving you the respect you deserve. I will make a deal with you on your education budget. And he did it in a way where the MEA had to go, it's a good first step, but, and who cares what they said after but. They said it was a good first step, so.
I want to talk about two of your former employers. I want to start with Greg first, your former employer, the DeVos family, Betsy DeVos. Why do people hate her so much? Why is she such a lightning rod of criticism? It's really amazing.
There's not a simple answer, but some of the contributing factors are she's misunderstood. People think they know things, but there's so many facts. Debbie Stabenow out today put out a fundraising email where the first bullet point was Betsy DeVos has taken millions from our public schools and sent it to wealthy private schools. That's objectively false. Like, that's just not true. So there's a lot of lies out there that Democrats like to believe. The biggest contributing factor, however, I believe, is she's taken on a controversial topic, and that controversial topic has an opposition. That opposition number is 1.2 million in its active members. That's the teachers' unions. That is more than all of our armed forces that are actively serving today combined. Now, then you have the retired teachers. So, I mean, they literally have an army, and they are the biggest political powerhouse of either side. And so she's taken that machine on, and she calls them out. If you heard her speech this morning, I mean, she gave a great speech where she noted that they're ruthless in their opposition to doing what's best for kids because they care about their own adult issues, which is fine, right? Like, they have a fiduciary to take care of their membership, not the kids. But when it comes to politics, they fight dirty and they fight hard. And so she doesn't care. She continues to plod on. And then you add on top of all that, wealth. Yeah. And then for some people, the fact that she's unapologetic in her faith. See, all those things tend to offend people who are radically wacky.
Going to the wealth, I think they feel like she is of that upper crust, the 1% who's dictating policies from up on high. And
first 14 years of her life, she spent in a 900-square-foot house in Holland, Michigan, on the outskirts of Holland, Michigan. And, you know, she was not born with a silver spoon in her mouth. She spent her summers working in her family business, painting and doing manual labor. She developed a hard work ethic very early, and I think you've seen that through all of her service, whether it's a state party chair or as Secretary of Education. Yeah, people have this green-eyed monster, jealousy, and they see that the wealth that they have earned and are jealous about it. But, you know, so what?
I'd also say, just briefly, before you get to hammer me on my ex-employer, she deserves a little respect here from theirs. It's been said there's a little bit of churn in the Trump administration as far as staffing goes, and here she is. She's still trucking, heading through full first term.
The longest-serving cabinet member in the administration,
yeah,
measured by the point of confirmation.
Hmm. Yeah. So what former employer do you think I'm going to hit you on?
You've had so many.
Craig Roche, Mike Cox, John Engler, Rusty Hills.
Let's do Bill Schuette.
Okay.
Fine, I've seen Bill Schuette around. He seems like the old Bill Schuette again. Am I wrong? I mean, he really seems he's in a good mood, and we're hearing he might run for a Supreme Court.
I think anybody that goes through a race like that and runs and puts their life on the line and puts themselves out, they're going to have a period afterward where they don't really want to see the light of day. They want to go home. They want to hide out. I spent some time hiding out. I had no problem admitting that. I'm back here. You know, I've seen some reporters have asked me, especially some that came from Washington. They're like, well, what's the buzz out here? What's going on? But some of the local reporters are like, well, this rumor of Bill potentially running for the Supreme Court. And I'm not privy, honestly, to where he's at in his head with his life. If I had his position and his wealth, I would be living in the Mediterranean. I don't need to run for office myself. But he is dedicated to public service. Meeting and seeing people is what makes him go. And if you look on paper of how would he fit up running for Supreme Court, it would kind of work for both sides, for the party and for him. It's always a struggle for any party chairman to find somebody to run for Supreme Court that is battle-tested, that knows how to run a convention campaign without being babysat, heck, that knows how to raise any kind of money at all, and he clicks all those boxes. And then for him, it's kind of a natural trajectory from what he's done. He was on the Court of Appeals, he was the Attorney General, finished his career being in the Supreme Court. That could make sense. Why he'd want to do that, I'm not really sure. But but if he does it, more power to him. I was also asked, what's the buzz on the island? Like, who is the biggest guest or the most impactful guest? And I think it is important to note that Laura Cox managed to get a sitting vice president for the first time in history. There's not been a sitting president even to come to the conference. So that was a big coup for her. And I really thought coming into this thing that Mike Pence has been to Michigan a lot. He is loyal. President sends him here. He's been, I think I read today in the Detroit News, 10 times since he's been vice president. So we've kind of like, you could go, we've heard him, we've seen him. And I thought the fight for the most selfies would be Dan Crenshaw inside right now. Somebody just walked out and said, God, he reminds me of Mark Wahlberg. Right? He's sexy. And then Sarah Sanders on Friday. Great personality, lots of stories. You see her on Fox every day. If you're a Fox devotee, you're going to want to get a picture with Sarah. We haven't seen her around here. We haven't seen Dan Crenshaw. But almost everybody I talked to today that came out of the Pence event said that he was fired up. He was throwing the red meat. He was hitting all the notes he needed to for the campaign trail. And the reporters that I talked to, not you two, so I'm not throwing you under the bus, said it was the loudest applause for any of the events they saw. So I think the...
It was certainly the loudest music of any of the speeches.
Yes, I was going to say that, too. I felt like I was back at Horns last night or something.
And I think if he needed to come in here in a submarine because the Secret Service said that was a good idea, that's fine. If President Obama needed to come here in an armored vehicle, I'm pretty sure the Democrats would have been totally fine with that as well. That's just silly. I don't know what the Secret Service was going to do if a motorcycle jumps out of the woods and starts chasing him down. Are they just going to yell, giddy up?
Any other thoughts from the conference? Anything else you're going to walk away from this, Greg?
Key up something that John said at the very beginning. You know, the Republicans are very unified at this conference, and there's a great deal of focus. And one thing that's great about this conference is we are a big family, and this is a bit of a family reunion. And so you get to see people that you've literally, you know, gone to battle with and grown up with. And so there's a great aspect of that, but then to see them all so focused and unified. I mean, this is a great family reunion this year, and it bodes well for us.
Anything else you want to say, John, that I didn't ask you about?
I like your outfit today.
Oh, I appreciate it. It's because I'm wearing fall colors.
You are. You've got it nailed. I already said I like McNeely shoes. Actually, I like John's shoes as well.
Well, Wow, geez, I like your shoes too. They're almost like mine, but not quite.
Not good enough.
John Selleck and Greg McNeely and John Rurie, thanks for joining me here on the porch with the ambient sound. I hope our listeners enjoyed it. That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. And thanks to Greg McNeely and John Selleck, John Jack, and, of course, State Senator Tom Barrett. Oh, I didn't ask you earlier, John, the flavor of popcorn that the Mad Dog, Matt Maddox, was handing out.
We got two bags of caramel corn and one bag of cheddar, I believe.
How long?
Jalapeno cheddar.
In this office, that will last until...
Those aren't that big a bag, so that'll be gone by this afternoon.
I was kind of thinking the same thing, but I'm glad you said it, not me. Thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Oh, and in case you're wondering, I did get peanut butter. And have you ever had apple fudge before?
Apple fudge doesn't even sound good.
Oh, but it is.
Is it like a white fudge or?
Yeah, it's kind of got the color of peanut butter fudge, but it kind of tastes like apple pie filling.
Maybe.
I'm diabetic and I can feel it going up right now, my blood sugar, just from you talking about it. So,
apple. And so I went ahead and bought it, and then afterwards the kids tried birthday cake fudge. They said, "Oh, we like this one better."
There you go.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Sure, these aren't flavored vape flavors that are out there.
We better ban those.
Yeah. We'll outlaw them, but then not outlaw them. Okay. Yeah.
Thanks, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.